secret world, and he was filled with the secret joys of it. The husky smell of hay that would be ready for its first cutting in a week, of manure, of his mother's roses. He could even faintly make out the aroma of Gary Pervier's triumphant honeysuckle, which was slowly burying the fence which marked the edge of his property, burying it in a drift of cloying, grasping vines. He put his cereal bowl aside and walked toward where he knew the barn to be. Halfway across the dooryard, he looked over his shoulder and saw that the house had receded to nothing but a misty outline. A few steps farther, and it was swallowed. He was alone in the white, with only the tiny silver sun looking down on him. He could smell dust, damp, honeysuckle, roses. And then the growling began. His heart leaped into his throat, and he fell back a step, all his muscles tensing into bundles of wire. His first panicky thought, like a child who has suddenly tumbled into a fairy tale, was wolf, and he looked around wildly. There was nothing to see but white. Cujo came out of the fog. Brett began to make a whining noise in his throat. The dog he had grown up with, the dog who had pulled a yelling, gleeful 5-year-old Brett patiently around and around the dooryard on his flexible flyer, buckled into a harness Joe had made in the shop. The dog who had been waiting calmly by the mailbox every afternoon during school for the bus, come shine or shower. That dog bore only the slightest resemblance to the muddy, matted apparition slowly materializing from the morning mist. The St. Bernard's big, sad eyes were now reddish and stupid and lowering, more pig's eyes than dog's eyes. His coat was plated with brownish-green mud, as if he had been rolling around in the boggy place at the bottom of the meadow. His muzzle was wrinkled back in a terrible mock grin that froze Brett with horror. Brett felt his heart slugging away in his throat. Thick white foam dripped slowly from between Cujo's teeth.
"Cujo?" Brett whispered. "Cuj?"
Cujo looked at the boy, not recognizing him anymore, not his looks, not the shadings of his clothes. He could not precisely see colors, at least as human beings understand them, not his scent. What he saw was a monster on two legs. Cujo was sick, and all things appeared monstrous to him now. His head clanged dully with murder. He wanted to bite and rip and tear. Part of him saw a cloudy image of him springing at the boy, bringing him down, parting flesh with bone, drinking blood as it still pulsed, driven by a dying heart. Then the monstrous figure spoke, and Cujo recognized his voice. It was the boy, the boy! And the boy had never done him any harm. Once he had loved the boy and would have died for him, had that been called for. There was enough of that feeling left to hold the image of murder at bay until it grew as murky as the fog around him. It broke up and rejoined the buzzing, clamorous river of his sickness.
"Cujo? What's wrong, boy?"
The last of the dog that had been before the bat scratched its nose turned away, and the sick and dangerous dog, subverted for the last time, was forced to turn with it. Cujo stumbled away and moved deeper into the fog. Foam splattered from his muzzle onto the dirt. He broke into a lumbering run, hoping to outrun the sickness, but it ran with him, buzzing and yammering, making him ache with hatred and murder. He began to roll over and over in the high timothy grass, snapping at it, his eyes rolling. The world was a crazy sea of smells. He would track each to its source and dismember it. Cujo began to growl again. He found his feet. He slipped deeper into the fog that was even now beginning to thin. A big dog who weighed just under 200 pounds. Brett stood in the dooryard for more than 15 minutes after Cujo had melted back into the fog, not knowing what to do. Cujo had been sick. He might have eaten a poisoned bait or something. Brett knew about rabies, and if he had ever seen a woodchuck or a fox or a porcupine exhibiting the same symptoms, he would have guessed rabies. But it never crossed his mind that his dog could have that awful disease of the brain and the nervous system. A poison bait, that seemed the most likely. He should tell his father. His father could call the vet. Or maybe Dad could do something himself, like that time 2 years ago when he had pulled the porcupine needles out of Cujo's muzzle with his pliers, working each quill first up, then down, then out, being careful not to break them off because they would fester in there. Yes, he would have to tell Dad. Dad would do something, like that time Cooge got into it with Mr. Porcupine. But what about the trip? He didn't need to be told that his mother had won them the trip through some desperate stratagem or luck or a combination of the two. Like most children, he could sense the vibrations between his parents, and he knew the way the emotional currents ran from one day to the next, the way a veteran guide knows the twists and turns of an upcountry river. It had been a near thing, and even though his dad had agreed, Brett sensed that this agreement had been grudging and unpleasant. The trip was not on for sure until he had dropped them off and driven away. If he told Dad Cujo was sick, might he not seize on that as an excuse to keep them home? He stood motionless in the dooryard. He was, for the first time in his life, in a total mental and emotional quandary. After a little while, he began to hunt for Cujo behind the barn. He called him in a low voice. His parents were still sleeping, and he knew how sound carried in the morning fog. He didn't find Cujo anywhere, which was just as well for him. The alarm burred Vic awake at 4:45. He got up, shut it off, and blundered down into the bathroom, mentally cursing Roger Breakstone, who could never get to the Portland jetport 20 minutes before check-in, like any normal air traveler. Not Roger. Roger was a contingency man. There might always be a flat tire, or a roadblock, or a washout, or an earthquake. Aliens from outer space might decide to touch down on runway 22. He showered, shaved, gobbled vitamins, and went back to the bedroom to dress. The big double bed was empty, and he sighed a little. The weekend he and Donna had just passed hadn't been very pleasant. In fact, he could honestly say he never wanted to go through such a weekend again in his life. They had kept their normal pleasant faces on for Tad. But Vic had felt like a participant at a masquerade ball. He didn't like to be aware of the muscles in his face at work when he smiled. They had slept in the same bed together, but for the first time, the king-sized double seemed too small to Vic. They slept each on one side, the space between them a crisply sheeted no-man's land. He had lain awake both Friday and Saturday nights, morbidly aware of each shift in Donna's weight as she moved, the sound of her nightdress against her body. He found himself wondering if she was awake, too, on her side of the emptiness that lay between them. Last night, Sunday night, they had tried to do something about that empty space in the middle of the bed. The sex part had been moderately successful, if a little tentative. At least neither of them had cried when it was over. For some reason, he had been morbidly sure that one of them would do that. But Vic was not sure you could call what they had done making love. He dressed in his summer weight gray suit, as gray as the early light outside, and picked up his two suitcases. One of them was much heavier than the other. That one contained most of the Sharp Cereals file. Roger had all the graphic layouts. Donna was making waffles in the kitchen. The teapot was on, just beginning to huff and puff. She was wearing his old blue flannel robe. Her face was puffy, as if instead of resting her, sleep had punched her unconscious. "Will the planes fly when it's like that?" she asked. "It's going to burn off. You can see the sun already." He pointed at it and then kissed her lightly on the nape of the neck. "You shouldn't have gotten up." "No problem." She lifted the waffle iron's lid and deftly turned a waffle out on a plate. She handed it to him. "I wish you weren't going away." Her voice was low. "Not now, after last night." "It wasn't that bad, was it?" "Not like before," Donna said. A bitter, almost secret smile touched her lips and was gone. She beat the waffle mixture with a wire whisk and then poured a ladleful into the waffle iron and dropped its heavy lid. She poured boiling water over a couple of Red Rose bags and took the cups, one said Vic, the other Donna, over to the table. "Eat your waffle. There's strawberry preserves if you want them." He got the preserves and sat down. He spread some oleo across the top of the waffle and watched it melt into the little squares, just as he had when he was a child. The preserves were Smucker's. He liked Smucker's preserves. He spread the waffle liberally with them. It looked great. But he wasn't hungry. "Will you get laid in Boston or New York?" she asked, turning her back on him. "Even it out, tit for tat?" He jumped a little, perhaps even flushed. He was glad her back was turned because he felt that at that precise moment there was more of him on his face than he wanted her to see. Not that he